Welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. Joining me from the train is Rachel Sklar.
Hello.
Hey.
I'm en route New York to Washington. I'm going to save Obamacare. Wait for me.
You personally are going to save Obamacare.
That's right.
How are you going to pull that off?
I'm going to reasonably explain to Scalia why it makes sense, and then I'm going to make him eat his broccoli.
You're not going to poison him.
No, broccoli's good for you. Broccoli's like new hot vegetable of Obamacare. I'm laughing through the pain. It's actually pretty sad, but
so you know, we're going to talk a lot about online activism, and you know, have you always been politically active? And you know, do you think? I wonder about this myself because I'm kind of the kind of person who, you know, thinks about things, reads about things, but when it comes to actually going out into the streets and doing something, it's harder to get me to do things like that.
Well, I think that there are different levels of, you know, acting on good intentions, and my personal viewpoint on it is actually that the so-called weak ties that Malcolm Gladwell talks about in his much maligned New Yorker article a few years ago, that's actually the wrong way to frame it. It's actually almost like a gateway drug to activism, because social media activism allows you to do something rather than doing nothing. So, like, imagine, you know, back in the day when, you know, the Sally Struthers commercial would come on, you would, you know, have to grab a pen, write down the number, and then take action and call the number to save the children. So now it's right in front of you. It's as easy as a Facebook like. And not every Facebook like is going to lead to a full-blown online activist. But for some, it actually will be a gateway drug. So I view it as sort of maximizing the karma.
So it's just a click away, basically, is the idea that you can just click on something and do some and take some action.
Not every single person has to drop everything and change the world. It just doesn't happen that way. But it's a entry point. People who are susceptible to that kind of awakening.
And you don't think that it's the kind of thing that it's just kind of making us feel good, signing something that doesn't really lead anywhere?
I don't think that at all, actually. I mean, my personal experience, obviously, it's like anybody who knows me knows that I sign on with passion to a lot of these projects. But I feel like, you know, not every single person has to do every single thing. I think it's enough, though, to have sort of a movement and momentum. And those, you know, those sort of the bottom of the pyramid base of likes and retweets really helps lift up the people at the top of the pyramid who are organizing and soliciting and, you know, organizing and taking action.
Definitely. Well, we've got a great rundown of you know, topics and guests on this, and we'll talk a lot more about online activism and just the role of social media. First, we'll talk about kind of how protests and activism become contagious and viral online, most recently with the Trayvon Martin shooting in Florida, but also with the Kony 2012 video, with the backlash against Rush Limbaugh, and many other things. It really feels like there's been a lot of momentum around protesting and activism online and through social media that have just had a much bigger impact than they did in the past. And we'll have a great lineup of a kind of a roundtable of people talking about that. And then we'll talk a little bit more about Pinterest, the social network that has been grown by leaps and bounds. But now there's some legal questions about how people are sharing content on Pinterest. Whether it's legal to do it, and they've just changed their terms of service. So we'll talk to Steve Eder from the Wall Street Journal about kind of the legal issues around Pinterest and whether that might hurt its growth. So first, let's talk about contagious protests online. We've seen kind of the way that social media has really taken off as a magnifier when it comes to activism, whether it's the Kony 2012 video, the backlash against Rush Limbaugh around his contraceptive comments, the protests against the Susan G. Komen for The Cure, And then lately, the shooting of Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida. The question is, what makes a protest go viral and become so contagious? And is there a dark side to it? What happens when someone gets it wrong? Most recently, with the Spike Lee sending out kind of retweeting the address of what he thought was George Zimmerman, the shooter, was actually the residence of a couple elder an elderly couple who I think had a son named William George Zimmerman, and they literally had to move out of their house because of the amount of people going and kind of harassing them. So, while we know there's such a power for social media, there's also kind of I guess not a darker side, but there's always the possibility that people can misuse it as well. Jonah Peretti is a founder and CEO of BuzzFeed, the first true social news organization that provides a pioneering mix of breaking news, entertainment, and shareable content. Mr. Peretti is known for creating viral hits, tracking online social behavior, and building technology to amplify buzz. Was a co-founder of Huffington Post. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries joined the faculty at Ohio State University as assistant professor in the history department and at the Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. Most recently, he was promoted to associate professor with tenure. Since arriving at Ohio State, Hassan has taught graduate and undergraduate seminars on the civil rights and black power movement and surveys in African American and American history. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Brianna Kayo Cotter is the communications director at Change.org, the world's fastest growing social action platform. Brianna loves social media, people power, and the amazing people who start and win campaigns on Change.org every day. Welcome, Brianna.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start with you, Jonah. You have been someone who studied contagious media for some time. We talked back in 2005 when you were doing these contagious media contests that were actually a lot of fun to watch, where people kind of had, tried to get the most page views in a certain amount of time. I'm curious, as you watch what's going on with Trayvon Martin, the shooting. There's been so many campaigns, the Kony 2012, the backlash against Rush Limbaugh, the protests against Susan G. Komen. We can go on and on, but just the way that things are taking off now on social media, it seems to be more than ever. Have you noticed what's been going on in activism, and what do you attribute it to?
I think things spread faster now than they ever have before. In the 1970s, there was early work done by people like Stanley Milgram and Mark Granovetter, where the ideas like 6 degrees of separation and small worlds were developed, and they were intellectual curiosities. Back then, it was like cool that we were all connected, but it didn't really matter in the practical sense. And then with the rise first of the internet, that started to mean that you actually could reach everyone through a few steps. And then with Facebook and social media, it's become more and more of a reality. So all of these kind of network ideas that we're all connected and that one person can share something with a few friends that then reaches millions of people, that's just been happening at a faster and faster rate. And particularly with activism, people are on social media platforms to share experiences with their friends. And if you're passionate about a cause, it's a great thing to do with other people. It's not just about the content, it's about engaging with other people.
Yeah, Brianna, do you want to jump in there too? I mean, you're running change.org, which has all these petitions, and I'm guessing you've really seen growth in the last couple months too when it comes to these things.
I mean, it's been absolutely incredible. More than 2 million people are coming and joining change.org as members every single month right now. And 15,000 people are starting petitions every single month. And what's most remarkable is that they're winning. Every single day, people go on to change.org, start campaigns about issues that they care about on any sort of issue, mobilize with their friends. Sometimes they get 50 signatures, sometimes they get 2 million signatures, and they're finding that they are able to have real impact on governments and corporations and policies that people have been working for decades to change. Now, it's like social media is like this, is this wildfire, that there's, you know, many of these issues, there's been a spark, there's been a small fire smoldering for a long time. And what social media, and especially things like change.org and Facebook sharing and Twitter are able to do is basically fan that fire until it's this unstoppable wildfire of people power. And it's amazing.
But isn't there an issue with, you know, starting something that's that could be, that might be wrong or that might be wrong-headed? How do you kind of stop something like that? We've had problems with, you know, Spike Lee kind of retweeting the address of what he thought was George Zimmerman and wasn't. And even if it was, I mean, is that really the right thing to do? I mean, I guess there's a question of people using it possibly for the wrong thing.
I think that is a possibility, but overwhelmingly, that is not the experience of what we see people using change.org for. Like, people go because they care deeply about an issue. Oftentimes they've been personally impacted by an injustice or a tragedy, parents whose disabled child was denied a kidney transplant at a hospital because of her disability, or a mom who's outraged about pink slime being forced onto the nation's school children. They'll go on to change.org, they'll start a campaign about issues they care about, and they'll manage to connect with people, strangers all around the world, who want to join their cause, make a difference. And I mean, I wouldn't describe it as negative at all. In fact, it's the exact opposite. I think this is one of the most positive developments in the world right now. It's fundamentally shifting the balance of power from kind of traditional corporations and governments and back towards people, and giving ordinary people incredible tools to affect change and raise a ruckus around issues that literally 10 years ago, 5 years ago, were just being swept under the rug.
So Hassan, I want to bring you into the conversation too. How are you seeing this, you know, these kind of tectonic changes happening in the civil rights area? I mean, you've been looking at something in the history of this. Is it really, are things really building momentum and changing in ways that you've just never seen before?
I think the most significant identifiable change between social movement organizing, whether it's in the civil rights movement, arguably the most significant social movement in the 20th century American history, or any social movement in general, is the rapidity with which information is being disseminated. When we think about social movements and how do you create change from the ground up, the methods of communication haven't really changed. I mean, the methods of creating a social movement haven't really changed. It's, you know, Brianna mentioned, you know, networks. You have to have networks. And Jonah said networks matter. These social networks, individuals reaching out and connecting with one another. The civil rights movement was organized not from the top down, but from the bottom up. Family members bringing in other family members, neighbors bringing in neighbors, church members bringing in church members. But that took a long time to reach out to people, to talk to people, to share information, to disseminate information, to grab people's attention. But what we're seeing with social media is that the medium of information dissemination has changed. So people are still building movements in a very real way by reaching out to those people who they know first. But because, as Jonah pointed out, you're able to engage with so many other people, and other people are able to engage with so many others, we're able to see the spread of these issues that people care so passionately about so much quicker. And I think that is really one of the most significant changes between past social movement organizing and what we're seeing now.
And Jonah, did you want to jump in and talk about, I mean, do you see anything that's kind of negative about the way that things are spreading? I mean, do you feel like there might be less thinking that goes on when these things spread, that people are just kind of spreading things without really looking into the details behind them?
I definitely think that initially there was less thinking and more emotion on social sites. So, you know, what Facebook started as was a place to find out news about your friends. And if you were, you know, in college and partying a lot, you'd see pictures of your friends at parties. And if you had kids, you'd see pictures of your friends' kids. And that it was mostly a shared emotional experience. And that's what people got out of the service. then people started to do content like cute kittens and funny internet humor and jokes and things like that, where you'd share a laugh with your friends. And now you're starting to see this shift where there's more substantive content and information and activism and these other things spreading on these social networks. But I think at its core, there's an emotional quality to content and to ideas that cause them to spread. And sometimes that means something that emotionally feels right will spread, even if it is a flawed idea, or even if when you think about it, stop, pause and think about it for a longer period of time, you're like, oh, maybe that's not the best way to address this social issue, or maybe that's not the best way to solve a problem. So I think things spread faster. There's a little bit less thinking and a little bit more emotion. And what you usually see that, as a sort of benefit is that once something spreads that is a little bit off, you see a sort of secondary swarm of people questioning it and figuring out how to correct what the problem was. So you do see a lot of things spread that are not really thought out that well, and then you see a lot of quick action to kind of correct it.
This is Rachel. I just wanted to add that social networks are now so much more integrated into the mainstream media. A few years ago, when Twitter was still viewed with disdain and suspicion by the mainstream media, now the main reporters are all of these networks, all of the big media outlets are using all of these different social channels, and so there's a very porous wall between different levels of influencers and different categories. That's just something else that I think really has contributed to the massive wildfire spread of social campaigns like these.
Is anybody worried about the kind of a mob mentality that happens in social media, where people are organizing so quickly that maybe they're not thinking about what they're protesting against?
I mean, I think if you're a worrier, you'll worry about stuff like that. And I think if you're a more optimistic person, you'll look for for the opportunity to do something good on these platforms. The way I see it is you can sit and worry about them or about these things, or you can say, all right, how do I take a cause that's a great cause and make something happen? And then just go and do it and fix the problem instead of worrying about the fact that there's dumb people in the world who post dumb stuff on social networks.
Yeah, I mean, I would chime in that I actually have had the exact opposite experience. People on change.org that start campaigns are deeply thoughtful and deeply knowledgeable about the issues that they're writing about. For the pink slime example I was talking about, Bettina, mom in Texas, starts this petition to get pink slime out of school lunchrooms. And she is a lawyer. She's been a food activist and blogger for a decade. And this has been an issue that she knows more about pink slime and regulation of the meat industry than like any person I've ever met in my entire life. But she had this kind of small, narrow of influence and platform. And then she goes to change.org and is able to take her anger at the USDA making this pink slime shipment into schools, starts the petition, and it just explodes. And people who had never heard about this issue but were deeply concerned about it as well were able to take action. And I mean, the movement within 10 days that happened on that campaign is remarkable. And this is a woman who knows every disgusting possible detail about pink slime. And again and again, it's like people, and you know, the Trayvon Martin campaign that was started on change.org, it started by his parents. And Trayvon's parents, I would say, have a deep personal knowledge in a very, very real way of the pain that they're feeling over their son's death and their need to get that story out there and mobilize people all around the world to bring justice to their son. And so I think that actually it's people that are the most deeply impacted and know the most about an issue, and they just have a new way to connect with other people to bring these issues to the surface.
Yeah, now that petition has, what, 2.2 million signatures on it?
Yeah, I mean, it's the largest petition in Change.org history. As I said, there's, over 100,000 people have used Change.org to start petitions around issues they care about, and it is the largest petition and was the fastest growing. And at some points in that petition, there were people, 50,000 people were signing every hour, you know, 1,000+ people signing every single minute. Like, the amount of anger and outrage that that tragedy inspired in many people in this country, it, what's remarkable, I think, is that social media gave people an outlet to take that frustration and that anger and that sadness and turn it into action. And I think that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and I mean, I would also say, though, that Trayvon and Pink Slime are both, you know, the phrase Pink Slime is a perfect, you know, way to generate outrage. The idea that you're eating something called, you're eating pink slime, it, you know, inspires emotion. And the Trayvon story is, you know, for various reasons has captured people's imagination, but there's lots of terrible tragedies in the world. There's lots of injustice in the world. There's lots of people who die, you know, for the wrong reasons or who are unjustly killed in the world. And that one of the things that social media does when it intersects with activism is it takes the issues that have the most visceral emotional reaction for people and causes those to spread. That doesn't mean those issues aren't important. They're incredibly important. And but it also means that there's other issues that haven't figured out how to provoke that emotion that might be just as important that don't get millions of subscribers. And so I think that activists who want to make a big impact have to learn how to play the game a little bit and have to learn how to present things in a way that people will have a visceral reaction and want to share with their friends and use these social tools.
Hassan, do you want to talk about what you think was the key to getting the Trayvon story out there, why it became so viral?
You know, I think Jonah, I believe, really hit the nail on the head. I mean, African-American teens have been profiled, have died at the hands of persons known and unknown for generations. I think, but the story really hit home in a way that other stories simply have not, partly because, unfortunately, we've become so immune to tragedy. But this had all the hallmarks of injustice that really resonated with people. And people, as the president said, you know, I could almost see myself in Trayvon. But I think what social media allows and did in this particular instance, I mean, it's sort of there are levels and degrees because it allows people in creating through change.org the petition. It gives people an outlet. As Brianna pointed out, it gives them something to do, a way to act, a way to express their outrage and emotion. But then it allows people to even move beyond that. I mean, so it's one thing to, you know, sign your name to a petition and discuss an issue with a friend. But it's another thing entirely then to show up at a rally. And that's another way in which social media has really helped or been integral in social movement creation in this day and age. Not only is it able to disseminate information, allow people to act online, but then it's moving offline and gathering people in really short amount of time to act in the physical world, in the physical space, and that's really phenomenal.
Definitely. Well, thanks a lot. I really appreciate you guys joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. This was a great discussion.
Thanks so much.
So now we'll talk about Pinterest, the hot new social network that has had phenomenal growth as a visual network where people can pin images, share them with friends in the world. Well, what about the images that they don't own? Is it enough to include a link to the owner's site? Pinterest used to claim in its terms of service that it could actually sell your content if it chose to, but it recently changed those terms of service. Joining us is Steve Eder, who's a reporter at the Wall Street Journal covering national legal news. He previously covered the hedge fund beat for the paper's money investing section, where he broke news on insider trading and public pension fund investments. Before he joined the Wall Street Journal in 2010, he covered banks at Reuters and was an investigative reporter for the Toledo Blade. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about Pinterest. You've been covering it pretty extensively lately. Is it on shaky legal ground when it comes to sharing, Or is it just like a lot of other sites and social networks that allow people to share?
I don't think that Pinterest itself is on shaky legal ground. I think that where the questions are for the users of Pinterest. The whole site is built on this premise that you can go and pin the beautiful things that you find around the web. It's taken on an enormous popularity over the last several months, but the questions really come up for those users. When the users pin the things that they see on the internet, do they really have the rights to those images?
And what about, this change in the terms of service? I mean, initially they had this very boilerplate kind of language that they could just sell anything that you pinned onto Pinterest. I guess there was a backlash over that. What exactly happened there that made them change their minds on that?
I think that there were some concerns among maybe photographers out there, people who are seeing images being shared on Pinterest, that what were Pinterest's motives? Pinterest is is still a fairly new company. It's a startup in a lot of ways, and it's finding its way around. So with this case, there were it had allowances, the terms of service that would have made it possible for Pinterest to potentially sell the images that were being used on the site. That probably made some people feel uncomfortable, as they were getting used to Pinterest as this platform, and Pinterest, reacting to that and a number of other things rolled out, a host of changes just last week. And among those changes were this idea that, we're not going to sell images. That's not what we were created to do. That's not what we intend to do going forward.
This is Rachel. I was just going to note that, amongst the changes that they posted were they were banning, posting that could be construed as harmful, like for self-harm, specifically targeting inspiration boards for where anorexics would post pictures that would help them, be thinner. I don't know if you've heard this term, like inspiration is sort of like a known term around it.
That was something that was on blogs first, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is, Pinterest is a new iteration of when I hear Steve talking about these issues about photographers and use of their images, like, this is not a new thing, especially for those of us who have been, we're in the 1.0 era of blogging. Linking out images, crediting where they come from, often that wasn't enough for certain photographers who were like, no, you can't use my image. And so there's definitely, murky use conventions around those, and Flickr created the Creative Commons notions in order to get around that and to designate images that were for freely being used across the internet. But when you pin something on Pinterest, you say where you got it. I mean, so there's it's very easy to credit sites on Pinterest.
I think there's a couple things there, though. I mean, one is that just because you're crediting somebody with the foreign image maybe that you're using doesn't necessarily mean that you're actually entitled to use that image. That's something that the lawyers will tell you as they give some advice on how to use Pinterest. I think the other thing that really stood out here was, Pinterest in its original incarnations had a couple things that it made clear to users. One of them was part of it, what they called its pin etiquette. And one of the pin five principles of pin etiquette was try to not to self-promote. Don't use Pinterest as a way to promote yourself. If you want to pin a few things that you did, fine, but don't use this as a big self-promotional tool. On the other hand, it had rules in terms of service that said don't pin things that you don't have license to. Don't violate other people's copyrights. There's a contradiction that a lot of people in the in the legal world were noting, saying that, well, on one hand you're saying don't self-promote, don't pin things that you clearly own, because this isn't here, we're not here for self-promotion. But on the other hand, don't pin other people's stuff they don't have license to. Well, what's left to pin between the two? And so there are some things. I mean, you can get away with pinning recipes, and you can get away with maybe pinning a few things that you own, or if there's some things that are in the public domain. I mean, there's plenty in the public domain, but a lot of the stuff is very old images or things of that nature. So you put kind of a funny, put Pinterest users in kind of a funny spot legally with, if you can't pin your own stuff and you can't pin other people's stuff, then what's left to pin? So now, as of these changes, they're saying, okay, self-promotion, that's all right. You know, we're going to let you go ahead with self-promotion. So that opens up a big usage of Pinterest to people as they kind of go forward and figure out what the site's going to be about.
And the other thing is that it seems like people would want to have things shared, you know, if not just photos, obviously, if you're a photographer, maybe you might have an issue, but you might also, if someone's pinning your photos and there's a link back to where people might buy your photo, I mean, it's going to lead to business for you. Or, you know, if someone's pinning, and a lot of these are products, you know, boots or clothes or fashion or home items or something. I mean, that's really just promotion or almost free promotion or free advertising for people. You'd think that they would want those pins.
I think it's sort of adorable to even think to discourage self-promotion on the internet. It's sort of a perfect tool for that. I think, like, again, like, I feel like Pinterest is just sort of like hyperscaling a lot of those issues that were coming up vis-a-vis image use on blogs back in the day. I feel like that's very much in the natural order of things. I don't see anything that different about Pinterest image use except for scale. I don't know, Steve, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, these are not all new issues. I think that the explosive growth of Pinterest is bringing some of this to a head. It's forcing people to say, especially in the legal world and people who follow social media closely, to say, okay, you know, look at how quickly this has grown. Look at what it's grown on the backs of, and is that okay? And so it's definitely giving you know, people an opportunity to take a look here. I mean, there's been some who've said, is this, you know, will it follow in the way of Napster, or will it, you know, sort of carve its own thing, or is this an opportunity to look at copyright laws? I mean, it's promoting a really interesting debate about, you know, copyright and social media and the internet, and looking at where we are here in 2012.
It gives you a lot to write about, too.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank our co-host, Rachel Sklar, as well as our guests, Jonah Peretti, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, Brianna Kayo Cotter, and Steve Eder. We want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to follow all the polls, news, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, Idea Lab, at pbs.org/idealab, and our new site, Collaboration Central, at collaborationcentral.org. We'll catch you next week with the triumphant return of Rafat Ali.